I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromise news media. Today on our program, Lori Mercier talks with Korean expert Martin Hart-Landsberg about the meaning of the recent Trump-Kim Jong-un summit. Our Left on the Law team, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, discussed the ruling by a federal judge in support of an ACLU lawsuit going forward against the Justice Department's policy of separating children and parents at the U.S. border. Bill Resnick today leads off interviewing Joel Jordan, a longtime high school teacher in Los Angeles, a writer, an activist, an organizer, a leader in the Radical Caucus that managed to gain power in the Los Angeles Teachers Union. They discuss the recent rising of teachers in two waves. The first, the takeover of local teachers' unions by progressive forces in quite a few big cities, among them Portland. The second, a segment wave of rank-and-file led and organized strikes in several red states, including West Virginia and Arizona. Bill?
Joel Jordan, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be here.
Joel Jordan is a longtime high school teacher in Los Angeles, an activist who writes a great deal, a leader of the Radical Caucus. 2005, the Radical Caucus managed to gain power in United Teachers, Los Angeles. It's the LA Teachers Union. Joel, for the last 20 years, public education has been under attack, defunding by state legislatures and campaigns funded by the boy billionaires to replace public education with charters or privatized corporate schools. The teachers' unions, of course, tried to resist, not very successfully. Recently, teachers have fought back in two waves of struggle. The first was a couple of years ago in a number of school districts, bigger school districts around the country. The radical caucuses would take over the unions. It happened in Chicago, partly in Portland and other places, including, of course, LA United. You were a leader of that caucus and became an official of the union. Recently, the second wave of teachers came in West Virginia, Arizona, Kentucky, Oklahoma, all red states. Without collective bargaining, they organized from below. They went on strike. Some won a good deal. Joel Jordan, tell us why the rank and file have organized over the last several years in those ways.
Sure. Well, generally, as I'm sure your listeners know, the conditions for teachers have always been not as good as they should be, and particularly in urban areas, much worse. And the reasons for that are both external and internal. And externally, we've seen, particularly again in urban areas, which I taught in, you know, most of my working life, over the last 10 years, especially increases in poverty, homelessness, low-wage work. That brings students stressed out into the schools, which creates problems within the schools that schools are not very well equipped to address. And then on top of that, internally, you now have had since even before No Child Left Behind was passed in the early 2000s, the testing regime, so that teachers are under huge pressure to measure teacher effectiveness by test scores alone. It hangs over the head of most teachers. The amount of paperwork has increased over the years. And generally, the administration, feeling the pressures from above at the school, then put more pressure on teachers to perform, and that means that teachers are facing a huge amount of stress. And I would say that that's the case regardless, blue state, red state. This is true everywhere in the country, as these tendencies, these trends are national. They're not local or statewide.
Right. And increased class sizes, particularly in California, and increased student mobility. Kids are moving in and out of classes, particularly in poor areas where people are being forced out, the foreclosures. The school is facing and being affected by all of the problems of low-income people.
Absolutely.
So, Joel, give us a sense of the teacher struggles in the big cities, and then sort of compare that to what's happening right now, which is the red states.
Well, in the urban areas, at least the California that I'm familiar with, I worked for years in Los Angeles schools, and now I work with feature activists in the urban areas of Oakland, San Francisco, Richmond. And there are big discipline problems in the schools now that need to be addressed that actually divide teachers in terms of what they think needs to be done, although there is general agreement that counseling services are practically non-existent. In high schools, the ratios of students to counselor is like 1,000 to 1, 900 to 1,000 to 1, so that actually no counseling goes on of any substance in these schools, and therefore behavior problems or acting out problems are generally dealt with punitively, which doesn't work. And so that's one consequence of the stress that is brought into the schools. As far as how this relates to the red state struggle, to make that transition, there the issues have been a little different. I mean, just take West Virginia, for example. West Virginia, class size in West Virginia is significantly lower than it is in California. California has among the highest class sizes in the country. And so the issue of class size, you didn't see that coming up so much in the red state struggles because, in fact, in those states, class size generally is lower than it is in many of the so-called blue states, and certainly California. And that has to do with per pupil spending to a certain degree. West Virginia per pupil spending is 50% higher than it is in California.
Yeah, I was amazed by that.
I've always known that California had low per pupil spending, very high student-to-teacher ratios. It's always been the case. And in these red states, the issues had much more to do with, at least initially, with the different forms of compensation. And they found that because in these red states, the Republican legislatures had made draconian cuts in the education budgets that went along with cuts in corporate taxation. So they cut corporate taxes, got less money, cut education as well. Those things went hand in hand. And so the fight in these states initially was really around compensation. In West Virginia, the publicity was that, you know, it was around salary, and they did get a 5% increase in their salaries, but at the end of the day, but the real fight was over the increases in health benefits costs that they were fighting. And so compensation is so bad in these states that all of them face enormous teacher shortages. Now, that the teacher shortage problem is national, but it's especially a problem in those states because of low salaries, cuts in education spending, and declining health benefits.
Tell me about the UTLA. That was the urban district. What was UTLA? That is the radicals that took power in UTLA. How did they try to deal with these questions and with the questions of charter schools and the rest?
Well, the caucuses that have the radical or social justice caucuses that have taken over UTLA over time. I mean, I have to say that in 2005, the caucus took leadership partially, and it's only over a matter of years, and actually since 2014, that the caucus has actually completely taken over that local. But the issues that started it were the fact that the leadership of UTLA was a traditional business unionist or service unionist leadership that relied on good relations with the school board at a time when the school board, well, at least the LAUSD administration superintendent, was unwilling to give the teachers a decent contract, and the union did basically nothing from 2004 to 2005. And so the caucus, which is called United Action Caucus, built itself on the grounds that what was needed was a militant organizing strategy to fight for a decent contract, because the union leadership had gone 22 months without a contract, without being able to negotiate one. So that was the immediate cause of it. But what we always fought for, and which gave our caucus enormous support among the rank and file, is that we took up issues of class size, which was something that the union leadership had always said before, oh, no, we can't take up class size. That's a state issue. It's too much money. We just have to fight for salaries. And even then, they didn't really fight. So the very limited approach to teacher conditions on the part of the leadership and the unwillingness to fight on the one hand, and the caucuses identifying of a broader set of issues, classroom conditions issues as well as compensation, was the basis for the victory of this caucus both then, 2005, and going forward until today.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mill Variety Hour. I'm talking to Joel Jordan, an activist teacher. He writes. He's a strategist. He's, what I didn't say in the beginning is that he is now a coordinator, one of the coordinators of the California Alliance for Community Schools. Joel, let's talk about the goals of your caucus, one of which was community schools, of really changing the structure of the schools, changing the way the curriculum, changing the culture of the schools, and changing the relationship to the administration of the school, with teachers having a far more collegial, and also changing the relationship to parents and organizing parents. But tell us about all of the efforts that were made within the those L.A. schools. You had, what, 1,000 schools in L.A. that you were representing at that time?
900.
Only 900. There were struggles in many of those schools to really improve the schools, was my understanding. Tell us about it.
Yes, the fight for community schools is really in a somewhat of a beginning phase over the last few years. You might have seen that the Chicago Teachers Union negotiated in its last contract agreement, negotiated a clause that set up something like 50 community schools in Chicago. Right now, UTLA is engaged in contract negotiations with the district and is also attempting to get the school district to fund and support the community schools. And also, UTLA is attempting in the legislature to put forward a bill that would fund community schools. And I just want to say maybe a few things about what community schools are. They really cover 5-6 areas. And let me just say that the impetus behind community schools was really as an alternative to charter schools and to privatization. It was to this idea that instead of charters, which are all about testing and discipline and authoritarian discipline, they tend to be privately run without control of teachers and parents and community, zero tolerance discipline policies that are meant to push out kids who may have some behavior issues.
And huge turnover of teachers as well. That a bit less well known.
Absolutely. So the thought behind them is to develop a culturally relevant curriculum in these schools, student-centered, that emphasizes high-order thinking, teaching that's done collaboratively, where teachers work together to develop lessons and evaluate those lessons and make appropriate changes in them, so a collective approach to the teaching profession. Leadership, as you said, that would be shared with the staff and with community and parents and students where appropriate. Positive behavior practices, what are commonly called now restorative justice practices. So instead of just harsh discipline, you know, expulsions and suspensions, that there is resources for peer mediation and real counseling so that students actually learn from their behavior and learn from each other. And also family and community partnership, where the decision-making overall in the school is shared with the community. And finally, and what community schools are most known for, but it's only part of the vision, is community support services, provision of kids to students with meals, health care, mental health counseling, and so forth, and also to offer some of those services to the community as well, to sort of integrate the community and schools together. So that's a vision of the school that we put forward as an alternative to privatization.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Joel Jordan, an activist and teacher, activist, strategist, writer, and organizer of the California Alliance for Community Schools. What about the schools of education? My understanding is that many of them, in fact, have not changed, but many of them have, and their teacher training now is moving much more towards these more engaged curriculum, dealing with local subjects, having students examine their communities, reading community history, and looking at U.S. history in a very different model. Are new teachers coming out with those, at least expectations, that the schools that they're going to work in have those ideals?
Yeah, in fact, there's an entire cohort of social justice teachers, teachers that are teaching in both traditional schools and charter schools, who are very much about social justice in the classroom. One of the challenges, I think, that those social justice educators have as they come out of some of the schools of education, which have this orientation, is that, of course, they come up against the testing regime, the top-down management of many of these urban schools that, that a lot of these teachers go into, and basically try to do what teachers have always done, is to sort of hide behind closed doors, teach a curriculum that they want to teach, and having a struggle with the site administration over that. And so that's a tension that goes on day to day, particularly in urban schools with young social justice teachers. Many of those teachers also see the unions as kind of irrelevant to the work that they're doing in the classroom. And that's a challenge that some of the unions, the more progressive ones, are beginning to take up, which is to link social justice education in the classroom with unions and with union demands, so that, for instance, the demand for community schools having a social justice curriculum is the kind of thing that has begun to attract younger social justice teachers into the union, whereas, you know, even the demand just for lower class size itself is not enough, even though obviously lower class size is a necessary condition for doing the kind of teaching that engages students in the way that they need to be.
One last issue. It seems to me the West Virginia teachers in particular, they saw their struggle not just in terms of the teachers, but of the whole staff of the school and, in fact, all state employees. That's a radical break, it seems to me, from what teacher unionism has become. Get as much as you can for your staff, and some of the weaker unions who represent teachers will have to do with less. Often it's just a fight about who gets what out of the state budget, and this was my understanding of West Virginia was they were in fact speaking for all public workers and public services, and that seems to me something really quite remarkable, actually.
That's right, and it has to be looked at in the context of a fight that targets the state as opposed to a local district. The traditional teacher union, and not just teacher unions, but other public sector unions, tend to bargain with entities that themselves do not have revenue-raising power. So school districts generally do not. They do not have taxing power. And because of that, there is a tendency in collective bargaining states, and by collective bargaining, I mean local district collective bargaining, there's a tendency then for teachers who tend to have more power and more influence than the other classified unions in that district that represent, say, bus drivers and cafeteria workers and sometimes teachers' aides and so forth, that because there's a limited pie to go after and no chance to expand it through taxation of any kind, there's a tendency toward basically screwing the other unions in order to get something for yourself, given the limited pie. But what made the West Virginia struggle and the other fights so different is that they targeted an entity, the state, that could actually raise taxes, and that's what they demanded, that taxes be raised or at least not further cut, like in Arizona that had a old history of cutting public education at the same time it cut corporate taxation. So what, for instance, the Arizona teachers demanded was an end to cutting corporate taxes, and in fact are now fighting for a tax on the 1% to pay for increased education funding. So that's a very important thing to understand, that these struggles were against the state, and that the power of the state to tax and raise revenue is key to making the kinds of more general and broader demands that were made in West Virginia. So in West Virginia, the health plan that covers teachers covers all state employees. The raise that the teachers wanted for themselves, since they are basically state employees, their employer is the state. It's not the local district. It's the state. And so these teachers demanded, why should they be different than other public sector workers? And then so they, because their employer is the state, and because they could demand taxes that could pay for improvement of salaries as well as of health benefits, it created a sort of, you could say, a material basis for a much broader struggle. And of course they understood that in order to make their fight and to popularize their fight in the face of the Republican legislature's resistance to even giving them 1% pay raise, that they had to broaden that struggle, and they did. So that's definitely to their credit for having done that.
Yeah, and another thing in West Virginia, they went on strike. and they went on strike throughout the whole state, and they prepared for it. It was very remarkable, actually. It sort of put the strike and almost the general strike strategy on the agenda. It made it clear that workers could withhold their labor and, in fact, require the employers, with the state or a private employer, to, although more difficult in some ways.
That's right. The state unions, the AFT and NEA affiliates in West Virginia, for instance, had been fighting for an increase in compensation for the longest time. It didn't ever get anywhere. And why did it finally get somewhere? For exactly the reasons that you said. They struck. They created power by doing so. They created a crisis that forced the legislature. This was a legislature that finally wound up, all these Republicans, all of them wound up voting for this 5% pay raise, whereas none of them were prepared to do this before the strike, indicating the power of the strike. Having said that, I would also argue that a strike is in itself not enough. I'm concerned that in the aftermath of these strikes, not just in West Virginia, but in the other states, the tendency is to say, well, we need to elect teachers to the legislature as Republicans or Democrats to further our program of increased education funding. And I worry that that will lead to the dissipation of energy and the co-optation of energy. And in fact, it could lead to going back to the preferred strategy of the labor officialdom and the teacher union officialdom. Whereas what I think is needed in these states, and the strike creates the power and the influence to perhaps make this happen, would be the development of some kind of ongoing political organization that continues to fight, that actually organizes direct action and continues to do that, and also runs people for office on a program set by that organization instead of relying on the Republican and Democratic parties, which in fact have been the part of the problem, not the solution. And the likelihood of these teachers who may get elected to the legislature being able to transform either the Republican or Democratic parties, I think, is illusory.
Joel Jordan, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Now, you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. Got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, won't be long. You got shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. Of course, it ain't quite that simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried.
Well, that was just a snippet of Talking Union by Pete Seeger. This is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now, Lori Mercier talks with Martin Hart Landsberg, Lewis and Clark College Professor Emeritus and board member of the CREA Policy Institute. The CREA Policy Institute is an independent research and educational institute whose mission is to provide timely analysis of United States policies toward Korea and the developments on the Korean Peninsula. What's the meaning of the recent Trump-Kim Jong-un summit? Hart Landsberg discusses what the mainstream liberal media has missed, how right-wing attacks do not further peace on the peninsula, and how ending war games and improving relations are essential for promoting peace in the region.
Thanks, Tom. Martin Hart Landsberg is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, and the author and editor of many publications, including the blog Reports from the Economic Front, and a number of books about Korea, including Marxist Perspectives on South Korea and the Global Economy, and Korea, Division, Reunification, and U.S. Foreign Policy. As Tom said, he's a member of the Steering Committee of the Alliance of Scholars Concerned About Korea and a board member of the Korea Policy Institute. Thanks for coming back to the Old Mole, Marty.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you.
We talked about a year ago, before the South Korean elections and when President Trump was more belligerent towards North Korea, echoing a long history of U.S. behavior there. But the recent summit with Kim Jong-un represents a breakthrough, doesn't it? What's the meaning of the Singapore summit?
Well, yes, the change has been almost head-spinning. As you pointed out, I think the June 12th summit in Singapore between the U.S. and North Korea was an incredibly important and positive step towards, I guess, three interrelated goals. One is the achievement of peace on the Korean Peninsula. The second is normalized relations between the U.S. and North Korea. And the third is movement towards the actual reunification of Korea. Now, I want to emphasize the word step. The summit moves us in the right direction from, as you were talking, you know, what we were really facing was the danger of a new war, a new Korean war. So the summit moves it in the right direction. There are many steps that need to happen. But the fact that we're talking about peace, and in fact that there's been concrete steps towards peace and a de-escalation of war dangers, is very important. I've been sort of struck by how many people, including people who view themselves left of center, have dismissed this summit as meaningless or, in fact, even as negative. But if I can just take a moment to list some of the concrete things.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like the media, and liberal media specifically, has been shockingly bellicose. And I've noticed has excluded Korean voices. And despite the Western media's claims, hasn't South Korean President Moon Jae-in really welcomed the results of the summit?
Very much so. In fact, about the polling show, about 83% of South Koreans are in support of President Moon's policies to promote reconciliation with the North and the U.S.-North Korean summits. And what's interesting is the day after the U.S.-North Korean summit, his Democratic Party won 11 of 12 by-elections for the national parliament and 14 of 17 mayoral and gubernatorial races. People are just incredibly positive about these developments. And I think that people in this country don't realize what the cost, just leaving aside North Korea and the U.S. from all these tensions, in South Korea, past right-wing governments have used the state of war and tensions to apply the national security law to outlaw a progressive political party, to actually dissolve several trade unions, to arrest trade union leaders, to break strikes, to restrict freedom of speech. And then there's the question of all the massive U.S. military bases in South Korea, the environmental, the social damages, and the threat of war. People in South Korea are just very positive about steps that will end this tension of war and create possibilities for democratic change in South Korea.
And it seems like another critique of the mainstream media has been that this agreement does nothing to verify denuclearization on the part of North Korea without mentioning at all U.S. military provocations on the peninsula.
Yes. I mean, let's just take a look at what the actual summit has produced both before, during, and after. Kim Jong-un, before the summit, announced that they were halting all missile and nuclear weapons testing. At the summit, he committed again to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which from the north side means no more production and actual maintenance of a nuclear weapons program. Of course, we'll come back to the U.S. side. He also agreed to destroy the main missile engine testing facility after already destroying North Korea's nuclear bomb testing facility. And he agreed to allow a return of U.S. military personnel to search for and repatriate the remains of U.S. soldiers killed during the Korean War. The U.S. side, President Trump, pledged to end these war games, which he correctly said were provocative. They happen several times a year. They include massive military maneuvers involving tens of thousands of troops, simulated nuclear attacks on North Korea, and they practice the decapitation of North Korea's leadership. And what's so amazing is that not only are there these, you know, ending these war games and the reduction of testing very important steps, but North and South Korea have been meeting since their own summit and are following up with the first meeting between the militaries of North and South Korea in 10 years. They're restoring military communication lines. They're talking about de-escalating the militaries around the DMZ. So they're very, very real, important developments. And the media speaks of this as somehow the U.S. has the right to continue to threaten other countries with nuclear attack, with massive war games. And what's so amazing is that when they ask the North Koreans to get rid of all their nuclear weapons, all the North Koreans are asking for is that the U.S. not bring nuclear-equipped planes or submarines or weapons themselves into the Korean Peninsula. They're not even asking that the U.S. stop its own nuclear testing program. We're continuing that. Or that it stops its missile testing. We continue to do that. So the idea that somehow the North Koreans are taking advantage of us or that this isn't a real step towards peace is hard to understand.
Yeah, it was even amazing that Trump mentioned that most of the damage from the Korean War was in North Korea. Pretty amazing concession to actual history that we haven't heard any former presidential administration mention.
Yes. I mean, the estimates vary, but anywhere from 20 to 30% of the North Korean population was killed during the Korean War. Almost every city was leveled by bombing, massive bombing, also the use of napalm. And what also is part of that history, which it is amazing that President Trump brought this into the public record, is the fact that the U.S. threatened to drop nuclear bombs on Korea during the Korean War. They introduced nuclear weapons into the Korean Peninsula in 1958 against the armistice agreement and have conducted war games, which included simulated nuclear attacks on North Korea beginning in the late 70s and through the 80s and on, long before North Korea ever was trying to develop nuclear weapons. So the notion that North Korea is somehow this aggressive state moving towards nuclear programs in an unprovoked manner is just not historically right. The North Koreans began to develop their programs in the 90s after the end of the Soviet Union when the U.S. continued to threaten them. When the Soviet Union ended, North Korea no longer had a nuclear protector. And the U.S. became ever more aggressive, which led to the North Koreans to try and develop a nuclear weapons program, which they have repeatedly offered to give up if the U.S. would end its military threats and embargoes against the North.
Well, what should people do? I mean, in light of the fact that, I mean, sadly, Democratic Party politicians have been introducing measures to try to insist on the continuation of war games, et cetera. I mean, it seems like the Democratic Party is becoming the war party or
yes.
trying to out-hawk Trump. So how should people, in moving forward, try to pressure Democratic Party politicians and also help assist this movement towards peace?
Well, if people would like a little education background, I appreciate the mention of the Korea Policy Institute. But if they go on the webpage of the Korea Policy Institute, they will see on the front page a link towards a reader which is can be freely downloaded, which will provide some historical background to U.S. policy towards Korea. But most importantly, I think people need to have confidence in their own reading of what's going on. Ending the war games are good. Promoting ties, normalization of relations between countries is good. It's good for people in North Korea. It's good for people in South Korea. It works against militarism in Japan. And it even begins to raise questions about why we need to be spending so much on our military here in the United States. So I think people need to have confidence, and the polls show that the majority of people want direct ties and direct contacts between U.S. and North Korea and support this kind of summit. So people need to have the confidence, and they need to speak out and write their legislators, but also speak in their communities and continue to put pressure on Congress and on Trump, because just as quickly as Trump, you know, has embraced this summit, we know that he can change his mind. But there's a moment now that's opened up where people have a sense of possibilities, and I think we need to seize them, speaking out, writing, challenging around positions of principles, around positions of peace.
Well, the Korean Public Service and Transport Workers Union have been really praising this agreement, but also noting that Trump's emphasis on economic development also perhaps bodes some warnings about the motivations of Trump for economic development there on the China and Vietnam model. And that, I suppose, that's another area in which people should lobby against that kind of economic development and overtures towards really capitalist globalization, including North Korea now.
Sure. I mean, I don't think any of us should have confidence that Trump's vision of what a new world or a North Korean economy would look like. But to the extent that the tensions of war recede, it makes possible connections across the border between North and South Korean workers and teachers and environmentalists and women's movements. And what's going to have to happen in Korea, and I think the unions in South Korea are very clear about this, that what they want is a process of reunification that allows for people to begin to shape what would a democratic education look like for a new Korea? What would labor laws look like? What would an environmentally responsive and responsible economic strategy look like? And I think that if the U.S. can be encouraged and pressured to actually make peace between the U.S. and North Korea, it means it opens up the possibility for people in South Korea to engage with people in North Korea and begin this process of discussion. One of the things that in the early 90s, I traveled to North Korea representing the American Friends Service Committee and was able to make contacts and help to create conversations between South Korean and North Korean teachers about educational philosophy and how to understand World War II and the division of Korea through meetings in China, for example. So there's a lot of ways in which people in the South and in the North can begin to chart their own vision, which if the U.S. continues to threaten war games, continues to create a feeling of national emergency, we all know what happens under those conditions. Governments crack down. North Korean government cracks down. South Korean government cracks down. The U.S., Japan, China. So anything that begins to pull away from these kinds of threats creates opportunities which are more likely to be seized in good ways by South Korean working people and North Korean working people to chart a vision that's not going to be the one that Trump may want to push.
And the fact that progressives just won overwhelmingly in these recent elections that you've just told us about, Marty, is a positive sign representing what happens with peace.
Yes, the current president in South Korea came to power when the previous president was impeached based on a massive multi-million numbers of people were out in the streets. But when he became president, he inherited the old National Assembly, which was dominated by the right.
Marty, so we have to conclude now, but thank you so much, Martin Hart Landsberg, for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot.
To keep the world alive and war to cease, we gotta have joy. True in our hearts, but strength we can't destroy. People hear us through our voice. The world knows there's no choice. We're making save the children.
Well, that was Curtis Mayfield. We've got to have peace. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now concluding our program today, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker are here with another segment of their Left in the Law series. On June 6th, a federal judge ruled in support of an ACLU lawsuit going forward against the Justice Department's policy of separating children and parents at the U.S. border. Hocken and Snedeker take up this lawsuit and what is driving Jeffrey Sessions and the Justice Department in their hardline policies on asylum.
Well, let's start, Mike, with what is old and new about this policy. Jeff Sessions has put into formal policy what, to some extent, has been happening for some time. And in spite of massive outrage about the inhumanity on display in separating children, thousands now of children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border, Jeff Sessions, the administration, has held its ground, describing this as part of their zero-tolerance policy, a term that we should always be wary of and should send a chill through us if we hear it. No good can come from it. Mike, tell us about what is new and what's old in this separation policy.
Well, parents and children have always been separated, if that's incidental to something else, like a criminal prosecution. But what's new here is a policy of separation. It's done explicitly to discourage people from making asylum applications or from coming to the United States.
My understanding is that the criminalizing of entry in the U.S. and that this is a different issue to some extent from asylum seekers. People entering the country illegally are now criminalized in a new way, and so there's a reliance on policies that allow and require children to be separated from their parents in criminal cases where parents are being criminally prosecuted. So it is, in that sense, relying on tough law and order policies elsewhere.
Well, there's competing laws. One law is the misdemeanor and felony sections of the federal code that make it illegal to enter is a misdemeanor, and illegal to re-enter is a felony. On the other hand, there is the fact that if you are in this country, you are covered by the Constitution, whether or not you're here illegally. That's been the case for a couple hundred years. It's also the case that you have a constitutional right to familial integrity, that the family, there are judge-made interpretations of the Constitution that have made it clear that the family's integrity is a fundamental right.
Barring some compelling reason to separate children and parents.
That's right. So practically speaking, people have been separated if there are going to be criminal trials or if somebody's going to be in prison, but there have been no specific efforts made to separate families. And what's happened in San Diego is a lawsuit where two people, both asylum seekers, although it wasn't limited to people seeking asylum, came here and were promptly separated from, even though there was no criminal reason, no reason having to do with them being incarcerated for unrelated reasons. They were just simply separated as part of the policy. And what the ACLU is contending is that this shocks the conscience. This is a violation of substantive due process. There's no reason to do it. It's done to, quote, send a message, hopefully, to, according to Jeff Sessions, discourage other families from coming here. But what the court in San Diego found is that not necessarily that's exactly what's been happening, but that it's possible that plaintiffs could prove that. So he did not grant the government's motion to dismiss the whole case.
There are rights of asylum seekers that are recognized by international law, and yet asylum seekers face a different fate in different countries. In Canada, for example, asylum seekers are provided legal counsel, they're provided social support, social services, and have many rights that asylum seekers under review in this country don't have, so they can languish and even be held for long periods of time in the U.S. while their asylum case is being processed. So given all of that, it seems like a pretty thin reed to tie the fate of so many people at the borders on U.S. existing asylum policy. It grants a bit of humanity, but even with this case, it seems pretty limited what you have to argue.
Well, true, but it's a very vivid, strong example of media presentation, for example. I mean, the issue is a very large one. It has to do with the coup in Honduras, which is the steadily worsening social order down there. My partner, Jim Smith, now represents a family from Honduras who were basically extorted. They're in a neighborhood that has been emptying out. People have left for the large part.
And the U.S. government is implicated in the fate of people there.
They supported the coup that overthrew a popularly elected president. They have everything to do with the economy. We have exported all sorts of gang members from in large scale from this country, from Los Angeles down to Central American countries. We run those places. And the direct result of our policies has been social disintegration. So people come here, and the most really dramatic and worst thing that of all the bad things Jeff Sessions has done has been to announce that gang violence and domestic violence are no longer sufficient reasons to support an asylum application.
And that's been a real important dynamic here in narrowing the grounds of these cases, and that's part of the ACLU complaint or class action suit, that so many of what historically have been expanded grounds for asylum, you know, initially it was very narrow after World War II, but had victims of discrimination against homosexuality, genital mutilation, women face threats of, and sexual violence. So this narrowing is really turning back history in terms of this expanded basis of claims. But it also seems to raise a larger issue of why people are leaving and the narrowing of a focus on why people flee and how the U.S. government is deeply implicated in the suffering of people and their vulnerability in so many places.
Well, at bottom, it's all a political question. But what this family separation policy is doing, it's making people aware that the immigrants from the south of our border are not all MS-13 gang members or rapists. They are include two-year-olds who are standing there sobbing while their mother is being pulled away. There's a range of people, and I think it's expanding that discussion. Now, nobody wants to own this policy. Everyone wants to blame the other political party or somebody else.
Because all that rhetoric and family values that women are purposeful beings to the extent that they care for their children. I mean, all of the hypocrisy of that is revealed rather blatantly. It's kind of like sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. You know, the hypocrisy is on display mightily. But to rely on children being ripped from the arms of their parents to make a moral case for opening borders, for changing policies around borders, also sets a very high bar for what's a sympathetic story at the borders.
Well, it should not be a bar, but it certainly opens a discussion. Once you recognize that this is what's happening, then they can make their other larger points that, well, there's so many people coming. And we can say, well, there are reasons why so many people are coming. And all those issues don't even become discussed. They're not on the table. And until and unless people really look at the whole family separation policy, I think it's a great wedge. It's an important issue, one that can be won. And to the extent that it's being discussed, the fact that among all the other immigration issues is the issue of family separation. That's not even been on the table. The whole questions that have been posed about whether or not Trump is an inhuman border maker have to do with keeping gang members out.
Yeah, and rapists and murderers. And talk about projection on the outside of the border. Yeah, on the other side of the border. I do think, though, that the larger question of in whose interest border politics and the sovereign power of the state to protect and police its borders has to remain central to a left vision. I mean, why it shouldn't matter where you're born. And it doesn't matter for a lot of affluent people who go all around the world. Capital is very mobile across borders increasingly, and so are people of affluence. Can go anywhere they damn well want to. And young people, middle-class kids, go abroad and teach English here and there. And, you know, the world is a small place for them. And who are the people who are stopped at the borders who have to have a damn good story of suffering to get through?
And a version of suffering that expands or contracts depending on demands of the labor market.
Right. And it disavows our dependency on the labor of people elsewhere in the world, as well as their basic humanity. I know there is one argument, well, they have to come in, take jobs that Americans won't do. And that also seems a very conservative argument, even though it, like the child being ripped from the arms of the mother, it does kind of undercut the most reactionary arguments.
Well, Jen, I think in 100 or 200 years from now, morally speaking, just as we now think the idea of discriminating against somebody because of their gender or because of their race is something that is not widely accepted, and it was as recently as 60 years ago in this country and 80 years ago, I think we're going to come to see that the idea that somebody's entire future should hinge on whether they were born in Portland or Mogadishu is going to be seen as really arbitrary and not right.
Yeah, and we've had so many times in history where borders were different than now and didn't matter so much, soft borders. And I want people to check out a demonstration at ICE. There's a group in Portland calling for people to come down to the ICE detention center in McAdam, support them today, 8:30 tonight. You should be able to find out about it. On the monthly calendar of DSA Portland and other left groups in town. Check it out. I'm going to go down there this evening as well. So, Mike, we'll be following this over time, and you're of the mind that whatever you can throw at these people, wherever you can find resistance, use it,
absolutely,
including through the courts, but we also have to use the streets in protest, because sometimes the courts are very limited, and even with the case you mentioned with your colleague Jim Smith.
Yes.
And just in closing, say a bit about how limited these cases can be before we close.
Well, Jim's in despair right now because he developed the facts of the case, which had to do with this Honduran neighborhood in a city where the husband was basically told to pay up a regular fee. He refused by the gang that basically had replaced police and every other part of the social order. And so they fled to this country. And under the new rule that says gang violence is no longer sufficient, Sessions says the world is essentially a miserable place, and the fact that you have a miserable situation is not sufficient grounds to allow you to come to this country.
Similarly, with women in domestic situations of domestic violence, it's like tough.
So politically, yeah, of course, it has to do with being active in the streets, but on, yeah, the ground, the law is the place where concrete cases get resolved.
Yeah, and there's nothing to minimize, and it's not an either-or proposition.
Not at all.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll be following this over time, and justice is in the courts and the streets. It's Jan Hawk and Mike Snedeker talking today about Sessions' policy of separating children and families at the border.
Thank you, Jan and Mike. Along with the ICE occupation tonight, tomorrow is Resist Trump Tuesday. A rally will be held at Senator Merkley's office, 121 Southwest Salmon Street, where we speak out to Senator Merkley's staff. You've been listening to the OMO Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patrick Kelberg has been our engineer. Tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the OMO mission.